How possible is it to really prepare yourself mentally, psychologically for combat?
Impossible, you might say. Training does you good. You know, if you train and you're confident about what you do, that helps. And I'll tell you what really helps is what they do today. They have these red flag exercises where they have dissimilar airplanes. You know, Marines, Navy, or something will go to Nellis and they'll simulate combat with a different airplane, somebody you don't know, and that comes pretty close. But in the final analysis, you know, you wonder about yourself. You know, are you going to fight or are you going to run? You kind of wonder. Can you imagine a guy going a whole combat tour and not seeing an enemy airplane?
And that happened?
That happens.
Wow.
Yeah.
Tell us about the Mustang. You know, we had the P-47 over there, the P-40. How was this airplane different? What difference did the Mustang make in 1944 in the war?
Well, I can make a case for you that the Mustang saved the war, saved the war in Europe at least. We were over there, the strategic bombers had been over there since 1942, and the pure concept of strategic bombing was that the B-17s could go in there by themselves, unescorted, and destroy the enemy's war-making capability, and the troops could just walk in. Well, it didn't happen that way. And they had P-47s and P-38s, but they couldn't go everywhere the distances that the bombers wanted to go. And in the how you operated in strategic air power, you got to destroy the defenses first. You got to destroy the Luftwaffe. And we had to destroy the Luftwaffe before we could make the invasion, that's for sure. Everybody understood that. And we weren't doing a very good job about it. I remember reading and the idea was that we'd go over there and bomb the factories, bomb the airfields, and destroy everything on the ground with the bombers. And I remember reading an intelligence report in January of 1944, and then reading it again in January 1945. And the Germans actually had more airplanes in 45 than they did in 44. So how did we defeat the Luftwaffe? Two things happened. The Mustang arrived at the theater at the exact time when it was absolutely needed. Brilliant planning, no way. It happened by accident. And the change of command. Everybody knows who Jimmy Doolittle is. Well, he took over the 8th Air Force, and the bombers and the fighters. And when we first got there, it was run by bomber pilots, and they told us what to do as our escort tactics. They wanted us to fly around them. They wanted us to be close. They wanted to see us. It was making them feel good kind of a thing, but not exactly the right way to do it. So Jimmy Doolittle, you read his book. He went down to the 8th Fighter Command headquarters, and there was a sign over the door. It said something like, the mission of the 8th Fighter Command is to bring the bombers home safely, something like that. And he says, who put that up there? And General Kepner says, well, I don't know. It was here when I got here. He says, well, take it down. He said, the mission of the 8th Fighter Command is to destroy the Luftwaffe. And he took those restrictions away from us. We were supposed to stay with the bombers, and when the enemy came in, drive them away and then come back. We actually had an altitude limit, 18,000 feet. And if you went through 18,000 feet, you had to stop chasing them, turn around, and come back. And that's what we did. And now what General Doolittle says, from now on, you pursue and destroy. It was an official policy. And that turned us loose. Once the enemy came, we were ordered to chase them to the ground and kill them. And that's how we gained air superiority. We actually we killed their experienced pilots.
How good were they? How good were the German pilots early on, later on? And what if anything, did you learn from them, if anything?
Well, they invented a lot of things that we use, like the Finger Four formation, the combat tactics. Everybody was flying around little three-ship Vs before them. Yeah. And the Germans developed that in Spain. And they were good.
What was a typical mission, if there is such a thing?
Yeah, the typical mission was 4.5 hours, or an average mission. We didn't take off on a typical mission. We did not take off before dawn. We sure did that on D-Day, but you took off at a reasonable hour. And what happened is the bombers took off very early, and we could hear them. We had a B-17 base near us. And once you heard them, you're still in bed, and you say, okay, we're going today. And they would assemble and get into these huge formations that eventually were 100 or 150 miles long, you know, with 1,000 bombers.
1,000 bombers?
1,000, yeah.
And how many fighters to go along with them?
Yeah, and another 800, 900 fighters. Wow. Eventually.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we would join the bombers at a specific place in the lineup. And you've all seen the B-17s and B-24s with a big, you know, like the triangle A or the square D on the tail. That's how we identified them. That, right. You know, our escort.
Right.
And then we would take them in and take them to the target, and we would that's where the flak would come up and look like a carpet, and we'd pull out and meet them on the other side, and then take them until early in days we were relieved by other escorts and we could go home. Later in the war, we took them all the way to the target and all the way home.
How often on average did you see German airplanes? Was it every flight, or?
No, it was not every flight, especially on my second tour after the invasion. The spring of 44 was the Luftwaffe was still pretty potent, and we'd see them fairly regularly on that time. And what they would do is that we'd try to get up in these huge formations and gather together away from the formation and then come around and make a head-on pass through them and try to overwhelm the escort. And so with General Doolittle's permission or ordered, we kept some fighters close, and then we let some of the other ones rove out there and find these big formations and try to break them up before they came into the bombers.
Who was John England?
Johnny England, England Air Force Base in Louisiana. That was an ace in the 362nd Squadron of our group.
What did he have, if anything, to do with your first air victory?
I don't know whether I want to tell that story or not.
Oh, yeah, but you got to tell that story.
It's kind of embarrassing for me. Well, my first kill, that's what the story is. And this was in, I guess, February or early March. And we had been flying, and guys were getting kills now. And Johnny England already had a couple of kills, the other squadron. And the hot pilot, Bud Anderson, what did he have? He had nothing yet. I chased him a couple times, went through 18,000 feet, fired a long burst, then came back up. And I'm beginning to wonder if I'm cut out for this, you know. And so this day was a Berlin raid, actually. And we went to Berlin, and we got relieved. And we were on our way home, and I think I had a three-ship or a four-ship, and another flight joined me from our group, actually the 362nd Squadron, where Johnny England was. And they pulled in alongside of me, which put me in the lead, and we're flying along. And I look out there way ahead, and I see a B-17 down low, and he's got one feathered, and the others are smoking badly. And he's in a lot of trouble, and he says, we're still in Germany. And I said, well, let's go take this guy out to the coast, you know. I kind of moseyed over there to the right. And as we're going over there, here comes three ME-109s bellied up to us, screaming down at the B-17s. And they obviously didn't see us, because there were seven of us now. And so we got three. I said, one of those is mine. And so we jumped on them. They broke up immediately and got into individual combat with other pilots. And the guy I'm getting in a fight with, now this is down lower altitude, and I didn't know this, but in a lower altitude, an ME-109 in the hands of a good pilot could give a Mustang a hard time. So we're down there turning, and what you want to do is you want to get on a guy what we call 6 o'clock. Here's your target airplane, and the rear is 6 o'clock. So you want to get right on that thing. And I'm not doing too good getting in this turn. My turns are not symmetrical with the German fighter. And I'm just thinking, what the heck's the matter with me? Why can't I get on his tail? And by pulling that lot of extra G, I can get inside of him and put my nose ahead of him, but I can't see him to shoot. And then he comes shooting out from the behind my, you know, from underneath me, because we're such a high angle off. So I said, well, the next time he comes around, I'd been through three gunnery schools, so I knew a little bit about shooting. I shot quail as a kid. And I said, the next time that guy comes through, I'm going to pull through him, make sure I'm lined up very carefully, pull ahead, I can't see him, and then fire a burst and hope he goes through it. So the time comes, we come around there, fire. And he comes shooting out from underneath me, and he's streaming coolant all over. And I, wow, he pulls up and bails out immediately. And I, wow, this is my first one, you know. And then I looked over my wing, and God, here was an airplane right on my wing in formation. And we were down low, and he had his mask off, and he was... And he was grinning at me, and he made a motion like this, you know, and everything. And I thought it was Johnny England. And he'd already had a couple of victories. And I thought, wait a minute. Did that guy shoot that thing down from under me? I knew if I had a shot, if I got him, it was a very, very lucky shot. And... we still had another 2 hours to get home, or an hour and a half. And I pretty well convinced myself that maybe I didn't shoot that airplane down. And I'm kind of pissed, kind of upset me. I didn't think it was very sportsmanlike, you know, if you shot down an airplane out when it, you know, when a guy's lining up on it. But there's a war on, and I guess it's okay. So we get home, we get the on a flight together with the intelligence officer, and I asked my wingman about it, and he says he was out of position and he didn't see it. So I said, well, I want to file a claim, but hold it until I talk to one of the other pilots. And they kind of looked at me funny. And so where am I going to go? Well, go over to the club. That's where we went, to officer's club after a mission, and then talk things over. And on the way over, I wonder, how am I going to bring this up? You know, am I going to say, hey, you blankety blank, did you shoot that thing down from under me? Or, you know, how am I going to do this? And I get to the club, and I walk in, and there he is sitting on the end of the bar. I didn't have to say a word. He comes running over to me, and he says, Andy, he says, that was the best shot I've ever seen. You got that sucker out there about 60 degrees angle off. I said, oh, Johnny, you know, lucky shot. And rushed to the telephone as soon as he turned around and claimed my first victory. And later on, Johnny England was the second top gun in our outfit, and he stayed in the Air Force afterwards, and he was killed in an F-86 accident in France, they did name England Air Force Base after that guy down in Louisiana.